We,
Sonia,
and Janooni are a couple of pals studying science in undergrad. We are not professionals.
Though every episode is meticulously researched, mistakes do happen.
If you notice that anything...
And we mean anything!
We state is inaccurate, please let us know.
Your comments, suggestions, and queries are important in furthering our personal and audience's understanding of science.
Thanks for being a part of this discussion.
We appreciate you.
We really do.
Bop, bop. Beep it up, bop.
Hello, friends.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Beaker Bros. I'm Sonia.
I'm Janooni, in case you haven't realized that by now. In case you guys didn't realize, we're called Beaker Bros because we drink out of beaker.
Because we're bros. Speaking of that, though, so I was off topic really quick before we introduce today's topic. I was unpacking one of the boxes that I had all my stuff in. I had a beaker in that, or one of the beakers in that box. I threw in, like, a little thing of marshmallows into that box because, like, I didn't know where to put it at the time. It ended up knocking over the beaker.
Oh.
So my beaker is now broken. But hopefully yours is still intact. I will purchase one at some point again.
So we're just beaker bro at this point.
Yeah.
Another bros is beakerless.
Yeah, so beaker bro plus
Sonia.
Me. Okay. We can have my name in the title. That's fun, too.
Yeah, just changing it.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sonia, did you want to introduce this week's episode? Because it's kind of a fun one.
Like all of them are. So for this episode, like Janooni said, it's a fun and interesting one. In my spare time, I tutor little kiddos in the math and the sciences. And this week, I was asking them questions about just stuff that they're interested in about science. And they actually asked some pretty interesting questions that I didn't quite have the answer to in the moment that it was being asked. So we thought, hey, why not talk about them on this episode? And then hopefully at some point I can share it with them in case they're curious again.
Yeah, I like that. I like the questions they asked too. It's very everyday occurrences kind of questions, but we don't really like stop to think about it. Or like when we do, it's just like we kind of accept it and we're like, okay, whatever. It is what it is.
Yeah, especially some of them with a little bit of background knowledge in science, it's pretty intuitive to get an understanding of what it is. But at a surface level understanding, it's hard to, you know, recognize why this phenomenon might be happening.
Yeah. Yeah, especially like because science is like everywhere in your life. It's occurring every day. It sounds so stupid because I know like when you're first learning science in elementary school, you hear your teacher saying that, but like it's really happening everywhere, every day, every second of your life.
Absolutely. But with that being said, why don't we dive into, I feel like I just dismissed everything you said. Like, okay.
Anyways.
But not to dismiss what you said, let's dive into the first question that you have.
Yes. So one of the first questions we got was, why do the sunsets or sunrises have different colors? Sonia, have you ever seen a sunset?
I have seen a sunset. I've also seen a sunrise.
You've been up that early.
I've been up that early. It's actually because I didn't go to sleep.
I was going to say that. I've seen a sunrise because I have not fallen asleep yet. But yeah, when you see a sunset or a sunrise, they're filled with a bunch of different colors and not just like a variety of colors, but usually red, yellow, and orange.
Mm-hmm.
But during the day, when you look at the sky, it's blue. Crazy fact. The same reason that the sky is blue is also the reason why, like, the colors we see during a sunset and sunrise, it's by the same phenomenon called the Rayleigh, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Rayleigh scattering. It's the same phenomenon that makes the sky appear blue during the day. So the light of the sun, or the sunlight, contains all the colors of the rainbow, but not all the colors reach the ground or, like, towards your eyes or reaches your eyes in the same like intensity. But there are nitrogen and oxygen molecules in our atmosphere that can actually act like little mirrors for blue and violet light particularly. So that basically means that blue or violet light reaches the ground, not as much blue and violet light reaches the ground. Instead, it like just bounces around in the atmosphere, which creates the blue color that we see in the sky. For sunsets, though, Light actually has to travel through a greater distance of the atmosphere just because the sun is at the horizon. So even more blue light or even some green and yellow light can actually get filtered out because of the greater distance, which actually leaves us with the, you know, the red and the orange and the yellows that we see. And that can also explain why the sunset kind of looks like a fire.
Interesting. Could you reiterate like in like two sentences, because I feel like we just said a lot of information there. So if you had to like summarize everything that we just said, how would you explain this phenomenon?
Basically, depending on the angle of the sunlight, how it comes through during the day or like at sunset or sunrise, the colors vary because what's being absorbed or what is being filtered by the nitrogen and oxygen molecules. So that's why during the day you see blue, and then at sunset and sunrise you see the red and oranges. So if you guys are looking at a sunset and you're like, wow, why, if one of your friends is like, why is it red and orange, you'd be like, Janooni
from Beaker Bros,
or just say Beaker Bros actually said this, and you can go on enjoying that sunset or sunrise.
There you go.
They're very beautiful these days. Oh, sorry.
Wait, no, what'd you say?
I was saying they're very beautiful these days, the sunsets and the sunrises.
These days, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, before they weren't, but these days they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The temperature's nice. Everything's just nice.
Speaking of us just awkwardly laughing there, I think that's a beautiful segue for our next question. So,
hey, next Sonia. Question. It's going to be like, hey, Sonia, why do we laugh?
Great question. This one was actually asked by, not that I have favorite students, but this kiddo always makes me laugh. So, anyways, he ended up asking, why do we laugh? Janooni, if you had to take a stab at guessing, like, how, like, why do we laugh?
Isn't it like, okay, with my minimal psych knowledge, is it like a social thing?
Bingo. So, yeah, so there's a couple of ideas. So first, let me explain the process of, like, laughing itself. So basically, inside our rib cage, we have these little muscles called the intercostal muscles. And before I get there, let me backtrack for a second.
Yeah. Ignore the intercostal muscles.
Yeah. So first, to answer this question, why do we laugh? I think it's important to understand a little bit of like the anatomical basis of it. So actually, when we laugh, we use our entire body is pretty much involved with it. So our jaw, our brain, our torso, our lungs, and even our blood vessels are involved in this action to get the ha 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 or the ho 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 out.
Everyone's laughing.
So when we start making that sound, our vocal cords start vibrating and we laugh harder and harder. And from laughing harder and harder and making that sound, we end up exhaling more rapidly. And because of this, our rib cage starts to contract, which can trigger like a sharp pain sometimes, depending on how hard you laugh, in the intercostal muscle, which is located within the rib cage. And the intercostal muscle, for a fun fact, is sometimes jokingly referred to as that feeling that you get is like, oh, it hurts to laugh, like my stomach hurts. It's not your stomach hurting, it's that feeling of like the intercostal muscle sort of like squeezing. So
I shouldn't be saying my stomach, it hurts to laugh because of my stomach. It's like it hurts to laugh because of my intercostal muscles.
Yeah, so you use, again, those intercostal muscles basically to bring air in and out of your lungs just by expanding and contracting your rib cage, which is the thing that sort of like facilitates that process. And again, just continuing with this idea, that ache that you feel in your stomach when you're laughing extremely hard is basically due to the rapid exercising of the diaphragm. So from like that squeezing feeling that you get from the intercostal muscles, you also get the diaphragm, which is right below the lungs, which is right above the stomach, by the way. So that's why it feels like it's hurting in your stomach, but it's not your stomach. It's more like the upper region.
So should I say my intercostal muscles are hurting, or should I say my diaphragm is hurting?
It's more so your diaphragm, but your intercostal muscles are also involved in that process, because the harder you laugh, it starts to like squeeze and expand more.
Okay,
so you could. Yeah, that's why I didn't necessarily dismiss that idea yet. I just want to get to the end of it. But anyway, so but soon after those giggles turn into like a full-on like goth sound, the diaphragm tenses up, the rib cage contracts, and the muscles get like a pretty solid workout. So it again pushes the air out from the bottom of the lungs, which is why laughter is such a good way of aerobic exercise. I was reading this thing where like 100 laughs is equivalent to 10 minutes of rowing. I'm not like that rowing action where you like.
Oh, they said rowing. I was like, oh, we're like growing taller or something. Okay,
no. No, not growing, rowing. Like using like the oars and the whatever, that exercise machine. But anyways, going back to understanding why we laugh, now that we know how we laugh, study of laughter is, it has a name to it, which I didn't realize. It's called gelotology. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but I'll spell it out. G-E-L-O-T-O-L. I spelled that wrong. Wait, oh, I can't read. G-E-L-O-T-O-L-O-G-Y. They all look like
gelotology. Yeah.
Gelotology.
Jello. I was like, jello.
Jello. Yeah, that's the study of laughter. And going back to what Janine was saying before, it largely is a social thing. So according to actually before I say that though, again, yeah, it's a largely social thing. People do it to as a way to sort of read the room. So there's active laughter, sorry, voluntary laughter and involuntary laughter. When you involuntarily laugh, that's coming from a very true place and an honest place. Voluntary laughter is that like awkward sort of laugh that you can do like, huh, but that's funny. Like you don't necessarily mean it. It's not coming. So like, you know what I'm saying? It's, yeah, I guess an easy way to say that is a fake laugh.
So my dad makes jokes and I laugh.
Exactly. Dad jokes. But yeah, we often do those voluntary and involuntary laughs as a way to bring a sense of community and like communalness to the environment that you're in. And it makes it, I guess, feel less awkward. So long story short, it serves as a social function or a way for us to signal to one, like another person that we, you know, wish to stay connected with them or we like their company and stuff like that. But,
sorry, I was thinking, I'm like, you want to become best friends with someone, just start laughing.
Full on, just yell at them from laughing.
God.
But going back to that idea of aerobic, I'm going all over the place with this, but it's a very interesting topic. Going back to that idea of aerobic exercise that you get from laughter, according to the Mayo Clinic, which is this very reputable health institution in the United States, there are a multitude of physical health benefits to laughter. So laughter can increase your oxygen intake, which can then in turn stimulate your lungs, your heart, and all of your muscles. Laughing also further releases endorphins, which are these feel-good chemicals our body produces to make us feel happy, and even relieves pain and stress. And the act of increasing and then decreasing our heart rate and blood pressure through laughter is ultimately calming and attention-relieving phenomenon that you can do in stressful situations.
Interesting. So that's why, you know, when school gets tough, I just start laughing.
Yeah, just stop. Like, I don't know about you, but there's been some situations where I've been stressed and I just stop and I'm like, you know, start laughing.
Or like when you start smiling too, just to yourself, because just like, trying to trick yourself that you feel good. You're like, it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, not out of a way, like, you know, being hysterical or entering some sort of, like, manic state. It's just, like, you smile and you're like, oh, my God, what am I into? Like, what am I getting into? Sorry.
Yeah.
But
kind of funny. Yeah.
Now you know, why do you laugh?
Wow.
I'm sure some of you already knew that, but now you know a little more.
Maybe. I was going to say, now can we take a moment to awkwardly laugh?
Ha, 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 ha.
Okay. Moving on. Okay. So this is actually another question that I have, too, that I was just, like, the other day I was drinking some water. I was drinking tap water because I enjoy the Markham tap water. Yes. Yes, I do. If I was in Hamilton, that's a no-go. But since I'm in Markham, I'm like, you know what? I want some tap water.
Okay.
So I went to get some tap water. Great. Had a great time. Water is delicious. Lovely. And then, so I leave. I go to sleep. I wake up the next day. Then I have some water again. And I was like, not as tasty as I thought it would be. It just like, I was just like, why does it taste weird? But it happens to me so often and I never learn, right? And I just suck it up and I drink it, right? But I'm like, I never stop to think, why does this happen? So guess what? I realized why it happens.
Why is it?
So, thank you, Sonia, for asking this. Thank you. Sorry,
you're welcome.
I was just hearing the plane going by. Can you hear the plane?
No, I can't.
Oh, well, there's a plane going by. Anyways, thank you, Sonia, for asking. So when carbon dioxide from the surrounding air makes its way into our water, it actually blends with the H2O molecules to form carbonic acid. Yeah. This makes the water more acidic and therefore not as tasty as I thought it would be. There's also, aside from the carbon dioxide entering the water, another gas leaving the water may also change the taste of the, you know, the lovely water. So many water treatment facilities actually add compounds containing chlorine to our water. And the chlorine is really good at destroying like bacteria and viruses. So it can actually impact the taste of the water.
Drinking pool water. That's fun.
I love it. It's delicious. And because we're used to like drinking water with like the hint of chlorine, because we're so used to, we're like, wow, this is what clean water is. We begin to like associate chlorine with clean water. But over time, as like water just sits, chlorine actually can evaporate into the air. And so when we go to drink this water, it doesn't taste as, you know, delicious as it did before, which kind of explains. And I was like, guess I'm addicted to the chlorine.
So, well, isn't hold on. Wait, so if the chlorine's evaporating, does that mean like whatever bacteria and stuff that's in the water is able to like grow? And like,
because, well, they killed it, right? So if you're dead, you can't regenerate.
But yeah, but like if the chlorine is no longer in there because it's evaporating into the air, then does that mean that water becomes more susceptible to,
I guess over time, yeah. But I'm like also gonna say like leaving it out for one day, it's not gonna be
not
like,
gonna do much.
Not gonna be like, the bacteria. But like over time, let's say a week or 2 weeks, could be like, you got some extra friends in there. So it's kind of cool. I remember one time, so we had this like person coming in, like going door to door selling water filter things, whatever. And it was so funny because my parents entertained this person and like let them come into the house and try to show us all their water stuff. And it's like, okay, yeah, go ahead. And they were giving us to taste different waters and be like, yeah, taste our water. It's so good, right? So they had took the tap water we had and lined it up with the different filters and just tap water and everything. So I had drank the tap water and then I drank their water. I was like, yeah, the tap water tastes way better. That tastes like trash. And then the lady just kind of looks at me. It's like, oh no, are you sure? I'm like, must have mixed it up. I'm like, no, that's the tap water, hon.
That's so funny how your parents entertained that whole thing. Like that was a whole event.
Like, it was
lined up the water.
Yeah, it was probably like they were there for an hour at least, too. So, I mean, my parents probably didn't have anything to do.
Anyways, the question that I got from a little kiddo who shall not be named for privacy reasons is, why do I sleep? Why do I have to sleep? Sleep seems like a waste of time, and I don't want to do it. Well, kiddo, when you're older, like, not that I'm much older than you, but you're going to wish.
You're going to want it.
Daily naps, going to bed early, there's nothing better.
Yeah, never getting out of bed.
Yeah. Anyways, so why do you sleep? It's an important question, and there's many facets involved with it. Janooni, if you had to take a wild stab at guessing, it's kind of an intuitive question, but there's a lot of processes involved. Why do you sleep?
Just for your body to, like, grow while you sleep. The brain to grow. The feet to grow. It's just home. So stupid.
I mean, like, when you're younger, sleep's very important. Mm-hmm. Like, it helps you with the rejuvenation and the growing and the memory and all that kind of stuff. So there's an element of what you said, which is not wrong, but I'll go into a little bit more detail. So actually, within the brain, there are several structures involved with the sleeping. The sleeping, yes.
The sleeping, I like it.
I'm not going to go over them all because there's many brain structures and some of them I can't pronounce, but I'll go over the main ones.
Hypothalamus.
That's one of them. So the hypothalamus, for those of you that don't know, is this sort of like peanut-sized shape structure that's deep within your noggin, and it contains a bunch of nerve cells or neurons that act on or that act as a control center, affecting your sleep, your arousal, your pretty much all that kind of stuff. And within the hypothalamus, there's another structure called the, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but the suprachiasmic nucleus, the SCN. If you're curious, just look up SCN brain. But anyways, this structure is a cluster of a bunch of, again, cells that receive information about light exposure directly that comes in from your eyes, and then also controls your behavioral rhythm. This light exposure thing is going to come in again later. But some people actually, with damage to this part of your brain, the SNC, with damage to that sort of area, actually sleep erratically throughout the day. And because they're not able to match their circadian rhythm with the light-dark cycle that's naturally occurring. And your circadian rhythm is basically your sleep cycle. So when your body recognizes, hey, this is time to sleep, or hey, this is not time to sleep. So actually, though, most blind people maintain some ability to sense light and are still able to modify their sleep-wake schedule. So that's in case you're ever wondering, like, how do people know, people who are blind know how to manage their circadian rhythm, their sleep schedule? Now you know, they're still able to filter in some sort of light. But anyways, moving on to another aspect of the brain that's involved with sleep is the brainstem. The brainstem is located, if you have to guess, you would probably be right. It's right at the bottom or the base of your brain. And this part of your brain pretty much communicates with the hypothalamus to control, again, the transitions between your sleep and your wake schedule. And there's within the brainstem, there's also other structures involved, but we're not going to get into that. But within, again, this area of the brain, there are these things called sleep-promoting cells within the hypothalamus in the brainstem that produce a chemical called GABA, or
GABA. You love GABA.
We love GABA. And GABA acts to reduce the activity of arousal centers that's within the hypothalamus that we just spoke about, as well as the brainstem. And the brainstem, specifically, like some of the structures within it, also plays a special role in REM sleep, which we'll be talking about again later. And it sends signals to relax your muscles and essentially your entire body, so we don't act out our dreams. Like, that's how you sort of like stay still when you're sleeping, because like if we didn't have that, we would be like acting out our dreams.
So I would actually So I would actually be flying.
Yeah, you would just take off. Anyways, so moving on from the hypothalamus and the brainstem and the SNC, we also have the thalamus. And the thalamus acts on a relay, The thalamus acts as a relay center for information from the senses to the cerebral cortex. And the cerebral cortex is the covering of the brain that interprets and processes information from short to long-term memory. And during most stages of sleep, the thalamus is pretty quiet, letting you, you know, tune out pretty much the external world around you, everything that's going on. That's how you're able to stay, like, pretty much, like, tuned into your sleep. But during the REM sleep that we spoke about before, the thalamus is active, sending the cortex images, sounds, and other sensations that fill our dreams. And this is why some people say that, like, you know, memories or your sleep's important for your memory because of, like, this area of the brain in particular, which we'll get into a little bit later. But there's another part, Janouni, from your MCAT studying. Some of these structures might be coming to mind. There's another one coming up. I don't know how to pronounce it, but the pineal gland. You know what I'm talking about? I never knew how to pronounce that.
I don't know. Pineal.
Pineal gland. Okay. The pineal gland, it's located within the brain's two hemispheres. So for those of you that don't know, the brain is divided up into two hemispheres. Got the right and the left. But anyway, so the pineal gland receives signals from the SNC, which we talked about before, and increases the production of the hormone called melatonin. Some of you might know melatonin because you take it to fall asleep. Well, this is where that bad boy is produced. And melatonin helps to put you to sleep once the light goes out. Another fun fact here. So people who are blind or have lost their sight and cannot coordinate their natural wake or sleep cycle using natural light can stabilize their sleep patterns by taking small amounts of melatonin. Or in case you were curious, and if you're having trouble sleeping, if you ask your doctor, maybe take small I'm not going to give health, never mind, I'm not even going to say take something, I don't want it to be misinterpreted. Ask your doctor if you're having trouble sleeping.
I was going to say, with melatonin, like, even if you take it, do you just sleep for the rest of the night, or are there still chances of you waking up in the middle of the night? I don't know if you personally have taken it, so that's
I've never taken melatonin before, no, so I personally don't know. I just know it's supposed to help with your sleep.
Okay, I've never seen it either, but just curious.
I'm going to say one more structure.
Yes.
There's so many, but I'm going to say one more. There's also the amygdala.
I love that.
The amygdala. It's this little almond-shaped structure, this little doodad, and it's involved with
nuts in our head. We got peanuts.
Yeah, we got a peanut, an almond, yeah. But anyways, this little dude is involved with processing emotions and becomes heavily active during our REM sleep. So just like the structure we spoke about previously, that is also involved in our REM sleep. Now, I've said REM so many times, REM sleep. Let's talk about the sleep stages here, okay? So we got four stages, or technically there's two main periods of sleep. You got your non-REM and your REM sleep.
Mm-hmm.
The non-REM sleep cycles consists of three stages, while the REM sleep period is one stage.
Mm-hmm.
During your non-REM sleep cycle, I'll go through all the stages. So stage one, this is where you change over pretty much from your wakefulness period, being up and alive, to starting to, you know, to sleep. And this is a pretty short period of time. It lasts, you know, about several minutes of active or relatively light sleep, and this is where your heartbeat, your breathing, and your eye movements start to slow down, and all those you know, muscles start to relax. It'll occasionally twitch, but that's just because, like, you're starting to, like, relax and all that kind of stuff. So you move into stage two of your non-REM sleep, and this again is another period of light sleep, but you fall deeper and deeper into sleep, and your heartbeat starts to slow down, your breathing starts again to slow down even further. Pretty much everything slows down even further. Stage three of non-REM sleep. This is where you're in that deep sleep period that you need pretty much every time you fall asleep at night to feel refreshed in the morning. It occurs longer than periods, and which pretty much your longest, or one of your longer periods of sleep that occurs in the first half of your night. And again, your heartbeat and your breathing slow down to their lowest levels during this period of sleep. And again, your muscles are relaxed, and it's pretty difficult to wake you up. So if you say that you're a light sleeper, you're most likely in that stage one, stage two period, and not really getting into that stage three period of your sleep. The final stage of sleep, arguably one of the most important, not to minimize any of the other sleep stages, but this one's an interesting one. There's a lot of exciting research emerging in this period of sleep. It's called REM sleep. And this REM sleep pretty much first occurs about 90 minutes after you fall asleep. And what's kind of weird is that during this period of time, your eyes move really rapidly from side to side behind your closed eyelids. So it's pretty much like fluttering while you're sleeping during this time. But most of your dreaming, though, actually occurs during this period of sleep, although some can also occur in non-REM sleep stages.
Mm-hmm.
And during this period of time, which is kind of weird to think about as well, your arms and your legs actually become temporarily paralyzed, which prevents you, again, going back to what we were saying before, this prevents you from acting out your dreams. So when Janoonie was talking about this is why she doesn't fly, that is mine. Starts levitating. It's like, what's that show? American Horror Story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Starts levitating.
Damn. But so you're saying I can levitate?
I guess so. This is what, yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the science fact.
You're welcome. But anyways, as you age, though, you begin to sleep less of your time during this REM sleep period, and memory consolidation, which is also a fun fact, most likely occurs between both this period of REM sleep and non-REM sleep. Fun fact, another fun fact. So based on your age, that dictates how many hours of sleep you need. So infants between the ages of 4 to 12 months, they need around 12 to 16 hours a day. Toddlers need 11 to 14 hours a day. School-age children, so 6 to 12 years old, need 9 to 12 hours of sleep. I don't know about you, but when I was younger, I always had to go to bed at like 7 p.m. And I thought, like, the sun's still up. Why the hell am I sleeping now? Because my parents knew that, like, kids at that age need a lot of sleep.
You know what's weird? I don't know what time I slept at. But I remember waking up at like 7 a.m. and I thought it was the earliest thing ever. I mean, it is. But I don't remember. I don't know what time I slept at, to be honest, because I would stay up reading books and my parents would come into my
room. Nerd. Sorry, continue.
They would come in and be like, you're still up? But I felt so tired. But I don't think it would have been that like late because I felt like 2 a.m. But it was probably like 9 p.m. for me or something.
So you are chronically sleep deprived.
Yeah. But there's also the time, I feel like it was late too, because there's this show called Ants in the Pants that came at 12 a.m. on Treehouse. Yeah. I would watch it quite often. So I knew I was up until midnight. That's about it.
Thanks for the sharing that, Janoonie.
You're welcome.
Anyways, so yeah, but as an adult, so, you know, 18 to 60 years old, you need about 7 or more hours of sleep.
I think I like how... How many hours do infants get?
12 to 16.
I think I need that.
Make up for the sleep that you lost watching Ants in Your Pants as a
yes.
child.
Yes. But yeah, if you guys have not fallen asleep yet, you have reached the end of this episode. Thank
Congratulations.
You.
Woohoo. You win the knowledge that you've gained from listening.
Yes. Well, thank you guys for sticking around, as usual. Until next time.
Toodaloo.